You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
So we are at the end of John. And, I'm not sure, but last week or the week before, you probably looked at this verse, which I've thrown up in past. And it's John telling us why he wrote this gospel. And he says, therefore, many other signs Jesus also performed in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these things have been written. They've been written for a reason, that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, that you would believe, trust in, that Jesus was the long-promised Messiah, the Savior that God had promised, that he is God, the Son of God, not just one of the many incredible prophets that God sent into history, but it was God himself who entered into human history. It was God himself who moved, he lived among us, he told us what he was about, and then ultimately gave his life. And why? So that chasm that existed between us and God could be bridged by the blood and sacrifice of Jesus Christ. And why? Not just to save us, not just, but it says that, but believing that you may have life in his name. The purpose, the reason that God entered into human history, the reason God has pursued us, the reason that for everything he did was to connect people like you and me back into a love, life-giving relationship with the one true God. And so that's why it was written. And so then he goes on in chapter 21, and we'll begin there. And John writes, he says, after these things, Jesus manifested or made himself, revealed himself again to the disciples at the Sea of Tiberias. And he manifested himself in this way. Simon Peter and Thomas called Didymus and Nathanael of Cana in Galilee and the sons of Zebedee and two others of his disciples were together. And Simon Peter said, guys, I'm going fishing. And they said to him, well, we will also come with you. And they went out and they got into the boat and that night they caught nothing. So that's the beginning of this passage. And so John says, after these things, after what things? After the death and resurrection of Christ, after the other appearances that Jesus made to the disciples and others, after these things, it says that Jesus manifested himself again at the Sea of Tiberias, and he manifested himself in this way. The Sea of Tiberias, it's just another name for the Sea of Galilee, okay? And he manifested himself in this way. It's okay, what did he look? So Simon Peter and Thomas and Didymus and Nathanael and the sons of Zebedee and the other disciples are all hanging out together. And I guess they had some free time. And they go out and Peter, being who Peter is, says, let's go fishing, guys. And so they go out and fishing. And what happened? They went out, they got in the boat, and that night they caught nothing. Now, maybe this sounds familiar. There are other experiences where John or other people, they talk about, here's the disciples, at least some of them, they're fishing, and they spend an entire night and they come up empty. This sounds familiar. But when the day was now breaking, so the sun's rising, dawn is coming, Jesus stood on the beach, yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. And so Jesus said to them, and actually we'll see, because it tells us they're about 100 yards away, he's yelling to them, children, you don't have any fish, do you? And they respond, no. And he said to them, cast the net on the right-hand side of the boat, and you will find a catch. And again, maybe at this point they're going, this sounds awful familiar. And so they cast, and then they were not able to haul it in because of the great number of fish. And so Jesus stood on the beach and they didn't know who it was. Now, it is possible that Jesus, because he's in his resurrected form, that he had done something that made him harder to recognize. It's also possible that in the early morning light, as the sun is rising and they're 100 yards away, they just can't see who he is. I don't think it matters. They just didn't know who he was. There's this guy yelling to us. And he says what he says, right? Tells them to cast the net to the right-hand side of the boat. Again, like I said before, I think this is maybe starting to seem familiar. And they end up with a significant catch of fish. And at this point in time, I think the guys are going, okay, wait a minute, there's some deja vu here. This seems it's been a few years maybe, but this seems really familiar. And so therefore, the disciple who Jesus loved said to Peter, "It is the Lord." And so when Simon heard that it was the Lord, he put his outer garment on, for he was stripped for work, and he threw himself into the sea. But the other disciples came in a little boat, for they were not far from land, but about 100 yards away, dragging the net full of fish. And so the disciple who Jesus loved, and again, it's never said directly, but it's very clear in reading the Gospel of John that this is John referring to himself. And so John says, "It is the Lord." Is he the first one that recognized him, or is he the first one that said it? But he's just very clearly, guys, this is Jesus. And Simon, Peter, being Peter, does what Peter does. And he just, with reckless abandon, I mean, just the incredible enthusiasm that Peter had, he just throws himself in the water and starts, without any concern, and starts, swimming to see Jesus. But the other disciples came in a little boat. Okay, they had fish, they had to row back. They came in a little boat, not far from land, about 100 yards away, dragging a net full of fish. And I imagine they're like looking and laughing, oh, Peter, as he's swimming next to him and they're rowing. It's just this picture. And so that's the beginning setting. They recognize who Jesus is because Jesus, again, does something with them that he had done with them in the past. And this is not entirely true, but it's a little bit like two bookends. In an early day when he was calling them to follow him, he had done a similar thing. And now at the end of things, he does the same kind of thing again. And I think there's a reason for that. Part of the reason was to remind them of who he was and what he was able to accomplish through people. Now he goes on. "So when they got to land, they saw a charcoal fire already laid and fish placed on it and bread. And Jesus said to them, 'Bring some of the fish which you have caught.' And Simon Peter went up, drew the net to land full of large fish," not just fish, but large fish, 153. "And although there were so many, the net was not torn." It's just underscoring. And so they get to land. Now, and remember, guys, they've been out all night. I don't know what the temperature was then. I've been to Israel. It can get pretty chilly at night. They're fishing. They're frustrated. They're failing. They're probably tired and hungry. And they show up. And this is a wonderful, incredible, inviting scene. There's a fire, right? There's a fire going. The smell of fish cooking. Unless you don't like fish, then that could be a problem. I've been a number of times backpacking and canoeing in Canada, and you catch some fish, and then you get a fire going, and you cook that fish right then and there on the shore. Somehow, it's like way better than every other fish I've ever had. That's the kind of setting, and there's food for them. This is a picture of invitation that Jesus is making to them. And he said to them, "Bring some of the other fish." So he went and did it, pulled it up, and there were a lot of fish, 153. "And although there were so many, it wasn't torn." Again, Jesus showing the overwhelming abundance of what he's able to do. Their efforts produced nothing, and here they have more fish than they could have imagined. And a lot of people wonder, what kind of fish were they? Well, we really don't know. But it might have been tilapia. I guess it's possible. I guess, actually, it's possible that even back then in the Sea of Galilee, they had tilapia. I don't know. But that would be if it's large fish, those are pretty big fish. Be pretty nice. I like, you know, in my head, I always imagine it's like something like, you know, it's 153 lake trout. That would be good. And so Jesus then, he continues, he says, come and have breakfast. Now, none of the disciples ventured to question him, who are you, knowing that it was the Lord. Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them, and the fish likewise. Now, this was the third time that Jesus manifested himself to the disciples after he had been raised from the dead. And so he says, come and have breakfast. Now, again, I think this is an easy thing just to pass by. Okay, he's feeding them, whatever. Let's get on to the main point. But again, he's not, in the face of their night of frustration, he's not simply giving them a lesson about who he is and what he's able to accomplish. He's also personally providing for them. They would have been hungry. And so this is, again, it's a picture of Jesus, his desire to connect with people, his welcoming, his generosity, and in particular, meeting even the physical needs that these men had. And then it says this is now the third time that Jesus was manifested to the disciples after he'd been raised from the dead. So this then becomes the setting for what is about to transpire. And what is about to transpire is a conversation between Peter and Jesus. And I think it's really important and instructive. And to remember, before we get into it, not that long ago, Peter, after a lot of boasting, denied Jesus to his face. And Peter came face to face with his own failures and limitations. And so then we see Jesus now moving towards Peter to help restore him and to give him renewed life and a renewed direction for his life, to see Peter freed from the failures that he had experienced. And so he goes. He says, so when they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? And he, Peter, said, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And Jesus said to him, tend my lambs. And he said to him a second time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And he said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And he said, shepherd my sheep. And he said to him a third time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And Peter was grieved because he had said to him a third time, do you love me? And he said to him, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. Tend my sheep. And so, three different times, Jesus looks at Peter, you know, and says, Peter, do you love me? Peter, do you love me? Peter, do you love me? Do you love me? That's the question. Do you love me? I find this a really penetrating question, personally. You know, we in America, we love a lot of things, right? I love OSU football. I love it. I love it to the extent that it can impact my emotional state for days. You know, it's like whether they win or lose. I really love it. I love a lot of things. You know, I love my wife. I love my children. You know, we love, 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 love. When my wife asks me if I love her, now it might be, you know, in a playful way, and I'm like, this is cool, but there's other times when I'm like, I must have done something that's making her think I don't. I think, you know, it's a penetrating question, you know, a penetrating question. And when Jesus, just imagine Jesus is looking right at you and asking that question, do you love me? I got to be honest. I don't know. I would feel uncomfortable just saying, oh, of course I do. Of course I do. And, you know, it's easy to think, right? I've been walking with the Lord for a bunch of years, you know, da-da-da, doing stuff. I live my life externally. I have followed God in a variety of ways, but do I love him in the way that Jesus is asking? I think that's an important question. So he asks this, sort of penetrating. And the first way he asks it, he says, do you love me more than these? Now, there's a little bit of debate about this, you know, a little bit of debate. What did he mean by these? Now, some commentators are going to suggest that, like, this is really a question more than the fish, more than this. Like, that in essence, do you love me more than your old life? That's how it's portrayed. And look, that's possible. I don't think it's probable. I think the context of this is very different. I think what he's saying here is, do you love me more than these other men sitting around the fire? I think that's what he's asking. Do you love me more than them? And why do I think that? Well, not that long before, Peter had been pretty boastful, right? It's the night before Jesus' execution, the night before he's going to be crucified. And he's informing them that they will all deny him, all the disciples. And Peter, right, beating his chest, gets up. No, Lord, these other losers, they may be weak, but I will never forsake you. That's what he did, except it would have been in Aramaic instead of English, right? He made a great boast and then was showed to be not really up to his own view of himself. He was busted out. And so this, I think, is Jesus giving Peter the opportunity. Okay, in the past, you tried to make it clear that you loved me more than anyone else did. Do you still think you're more than them? I think he's given Peter an opportunity. And what does Peter say? He goes on, he says, do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? These questions. Now, what I think is interesting but also important is that different words for love are used here. In English, we have one word for love. Love, right? And you can love peanut butter, football, your wife, God. It's love. And what we do is if we want to emphasize something, we add words to it, right? So, you know, young love, puppy love, right? That kind of thing, romantic love. We add a word to help explain what we mean. But in Greek, there are three primary words that were used. One was eros, it's romantic or passionate love. It's, you know, that kind of thing, passion. Another word, phileo, Philadelphia, brotherly love, right? It's a strong love. It includes loyalty. It's, you know, familial love. It's valuable and important. But then there's this fairly unique word, agape. And this word for love, this is all in love. This is, I will give everything I have for you, love. Which again, if we're honest, there aren't that many people. When my children, maybe, and my wife, but I'm just being honest, my children were definitely, they were people I would have given anything for. And my wife on my better days, when she wasn't, you know, informing me about improvements I needed to make in my life, I felt that same way. But there are just not that many people, okay, that I would literally run into a burning building to save. I love you guys. You guys are cool. Oh, dude, that sucks for you. I mean, I don't know. And if my child was in there, I'd pass you right by to get my kid. That's just the reality. That kind of love. But that's those three different words. And the first two times that Jesus asked this question, he uses the word agape is used. Peter, do you love me in the fullest possible way? Do you love me? Do you have the kind of love that you would give all that you have for me? Do you have the kind of love for me where you would lay your life down for me? That's what Jesus is asking. And again, in the context, part of this is because of the boast that he was making. And Peter's response the first two times, he says, Lord, you know that I love you. Lord, you know that I love you. But he uses a different word. And the word here is phileo. You know that I have affection for you. You know that I have a kind of loyalty and appreciation for you. You know that. Intentionally saying, it's not agape, God. I don't have that. I don't have that. I think this is a sign of humility on Peter's part. The man who was so boastful, you know, arrogant, confident, sure that he was more committed and loved Jesus than more than everybody else did, was shown that that wasn't true. And so he's, in a more humble way, I think, just saying, you know, that you know, Lord, that I love you with a small L, a small L. He goes on. Jesus then, his response is, all right, tend my lambs, shepherd my sheep. If we remember the, you know, the picture where Jesus describes himself as the good shepherd, what does this mean? It's caring for, providing for, protecting. It's providing everything the sheep need to be able to be safe and thrive. I was in Ireland a couple weeks ago in part to visit some relatives. They got a lot of sheep in Ireland. I mean, everywhere you go. I mean, like, we were kind of laughing at a certain point. Like, you know, it's like, well, they have a lot of sheep. They have some cows. You didn't see much of anything else unless you climbed up into the mountains. But, you know, there's a lot of sheep. And I watched. I was in an Airbnb one morning drinking coffee. And below me is this just kind of idyllic scene. And here are these sheep. And the shepherd comes. And he moves the sheep from there to another pasture, feeds them. That's the picture that Jesus was trying. When he says, tend my sheep, shepherd my lambs, feed them, provide for them, protect them. That's what Jesus calls on Peter to do. Well, he goes on. Well, before that, I think a lot of times we can overly complicate the Christian life, right? But the center of the Christian life, the center of what it means to be a follower of Christ, isn't complicated. We complicate it. We make it all kinds of other things, but the center is really clear. Jesus loves us. He loved us to the extent he was willing to give his life for us. He pursues us. He provides us with all the things that we need. According to Ephesians chapter 1, he has literally given us the best that heaven has to offer. Right? He is so generous to us and has loved us so well. And as we understand and experience that, we respond, right? Our response is that we turn around and love people. That's the center of what it means to follow Christ, right? What is a Christian? A Christian is someone who is following Christ, and one of the things that is going to be evident in their life is how they love people. What did Jesus say? A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another even as I have loved you. It's not about being cleaner than other people. A lot of times when you look at, you know, Christianity as it's represented in the world, you get the picture sometimes that being a Christian means that I'm cleaner than other people. That I sin less, I smoke less, I cuss less, I drink, well, whatever. Whatever it is, it's cleaner, okay? And one of the byproducts of following Christ and loving people is sometimes our life does get cleaned up. That's a byproduct, and it's good. It's also that it's not about being more put together than other people, right? Of course, as we pursue a life of loving people, God also works in our life to transform us and change us, but not so that we're cleaner. He does it so that we're more useful to him in his desire to love other people. That's the center of the thing. Not being clean, not being better, not being more holy or whatever it's looked, but it's a call to love. And that is exactly what Jesus, as he is moving to restore Peter, he says, okay, you love me a little, love my sheep. He goes on. He said to him a third time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And I don't think we should miss the fact that this three times Jesus denied him. I mean, Peter denied Jesus, and three times Jesus asked this question. But this time, when he uses love, he says, do you phileo me? Okay, Peter, you don't love me with the big L, capital L love. Do you love me a little? Do you love me this way? And Peter was grieved because he had heard a third time, do you love me? And I think he was grieved because, like I said, it was a third time like his denials. It may be true that he was a little grieved also because Jesus changed the word. But I think more it's the case he's confronted with his own three denials of Jesus. And so he's grieved. He's just being busted out by this. Peter had his failure and limitation slammed in his face. He boasted great boasts, and he fell really hard. And at the end, to his great and historical embarrassment, it was even a little slave girl was the last one he denied Jesus to because of his fear. He was so far from the man that he thought he was. And this is just being jammed. That was jammed in his face. Can you relate to that? Can you relate to that? I sure can. I can relate to being overconfident and cocky and sure and believing that, you know, the kinds of things I was going to accomplish. I can relate to all of it. I can relate to thinking I was more committed than other people. The reality is there's nothing Peter did. Just about no embarrassing thing Peter did that I didn't do, and it wasn't me. I relate to this, and I can relate so strongly to those moments in time when God got my attention, and, you know, the failure, the sin, my own limitations coming slamming in my face, I can relate to this. And I can also relate to the value of God bringing that up in our lives. Just like with Peter. So he was deeply grieved, saddened. And what's his response? Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. You know that I phileo you. And he's just saying, there's nothing hidden from you, God. I can't pretend. I am capable, I am completely capable of deceiving probably just almost everybody in my life. Okay, we're capable of that, but not God. In those honest moments when we just stand before him and you're like, Lord, you know my heart, my thoughts, my mind, you know everything about me. And just without pretense, just being honest. And in this case, the honesty was, you know, I love you a little. I love you a little. And his response was, tend my sheep. And my sheep. I think it's important what he didn't say in the face of that failure. He didn't say, well, Peter, that was bad. You need to clean up your act and perhaps later I can use you. After a time of, you know, retraining and so forth, then maybe I can use you. Doesn't say that. He doesn't say, you know, feel real bad for a good long time, Peter. I want you to wallow in that pain. I want you to wallow in that misery. Do some penance. Feel terrible for a while. And when you've done enough of that, maybe I can use you. Doesn't say that. He also doesn't say, sorry, friend, but it's over for you. Now, I can imagine, because I have felt this way in my life, I can imagine Peter, after what happened, really wondering if there was going to be any place for him in an ongoing way and what God wanted. But he doesn't say it's over. He doesn't. Instead, he looks at Peter and he charges Peter to do what? Tend my sheep. He releases him into a life of productive ministry, which Peter ended up having. Remarkably productive. That man who had been so unstable, so untrustworthy, so full of himself, God worked to restore, and he became a man useful to God in incredible ways. Tend my sheep. How do we respond to failure? How do we respond to our weakness and limitations? How do we express even our lesser love of God? Right? You may be sitting here and thinking, I'm not sure I love God as much as somebody else does. That was true of Peter. And how do we respond to those things? Well, according to this passage, sure, there may be other things, but according to this passage, part of our response is simply to be honest with God about those things and then begin to move towards other people and serve them, to love them. That's how we respond to failure. God, just like Peter, looked at him, Peter understood, God understood, and he said, okay, you love me a little, move towards people and love. Love them. Love them. I think that's awesome. And then he goes on. He says, truly, truly, I say to you, when you were younger, you used to gird yourself and walk wherever you wish. But when you grow old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will gird you and bring you where you do not wish to go. Now this he said, signifying what kind of death he would glorify God. And when he had spoken this, he said, follow me. And so what's he say? He says, first of all, when you were younger, you used to gird yourself and walk wherever you wished. What's he saying? Peter, oh Peter, you were a cocky, self-willed, do whatever you want. Free, you know, you just felt free and moved and you had confidence. That's who you were. But a time is coming when you grow old, you'll stretch out your hands and someone else will gird you and take you where you don't want to go. And we don't have to really speculate what he means here because Jesus said this, it was signifying, but what kind of death Peter would glorify God, how Peter was going to die. And the truth is, Peter did become the man he hoped he would be. He did become a man who was useful for God. You know, we have letters in the New Testament written by Peter that are super helpful. He played a significant role in the early church, an important role. He was restored by God. But he also ultimately, like many of the apostles, the majority of them, in the end of his life, he did remain faithful to Christ, even unto death. And he was crucified. He was executed, Peter, simply because he would not deny that Jesus was who he claimed to be. He remained faithful to the end. He was fully restored. And then he says, after he spoke these things, he said, follow me. Now, again, my friends, this is a fairly uncomplicated call. We often, like I said earlier about other things, we often complicate the Christian life. What does it take? What does it mean? What does it look like? This call Jesus makes to all of us, it's simply follow me. Follow me. Follow me as I seek to save the lost. Follow me as I move into the lives of broken people to love them. Follow me into a life of service. Follow me as I work in your life to transform you. Follow me and cooperate with me as I try to shape you into the man or woman I want you to be. Follow me. That's not complicated. Now, it's sometimes confusing and sometimes it can be frustrating, but it isn't complicated. Right? Today, God is calling us to Him. There's a thing, whatever it is in front of us, all we have to do is start following Him, and then He'll bring up the next thing and the next thing and redirect us. He'll do that. Uncomplicated, which is good for me. I'm kind of a caveman, really. I'm a Neanderthal. I like things simple. This I can do. All right, Lord. What do you have for me today? What do you have for me now? Where are you leading me? I can do that. Even I can do that. Peter turned around. Interesting. He turned around and saw the disciples who Jesus loved following him, the one who also had leaned back meaning Jesus' bosom, at the supper and said, Lord, who is the one that betrays you? So he turns around and he's seeing John there. John is an eyewitness to this event. And Peter, seeing him, said to Jesus, Lord, what about this man? And Jesus said to him, if I want him to remain until I come, what is it to you? You follow me. And therefore this saying went out among the brethren that the disciples would not, that disciple would not die. Yet Jesus did not say that he would not die, but only, if I want him to remain until I come, what is that to you? And so Peter, even after all this, I don't know exactly what's going through Peter's mind. I don't know exactly why he asked this question, but he turns around, he sees John. He says, okay, you're telling me I'm going to die this way. What about this guy? Was it a comparison he was making? Was he just, you know, interested? Well, the Jesus' response seems to indicate it was more than just idle interest in, you know, John's future. Because he says to him, if I want him to remain until I come, what is it to you? You follow me. And what he's saying, I think, at least in part, to Peter at this time, is like, look, your job is to follow me. Your job is to respond to what I'm doing in your life. Your job is not to compare yourself to other people. It's not, you know, we move towards people to encourage and strengthen. We want to see people, you know, other people learn, fall more deeply in love with Jesus, and we want to see other people find faith in Christ. But we don't compare. We don't do this thing where this guy seems to have it easier than me. God has called each of us into a particular path. Yes, there's a corporate experience, but there's an individual experience. And some people are going to have an easier or harder time than others. Some people in this life are going to seemingly have more fruit than we have, or they're more talented or more gifted. We're not supposed to worry about those things. What we worry about is we keep our eyes fixed on Jesus and we follow him. And that is what he's calling Peter to do. And then he makes this comment, which I think is funny. This thing was said, and then this rumor goes around among the, you know, the brethren, the early church, thinking, well, I think Jesus said that John was never going to die. And John's like, yeah, no, that's not what he said. It's not what he said. Now, John did end up living a good long time, but he did ultimately die. So, this is the disciple who testifies to these things and wrote these things, and we know that his testimony is true. And there are also many other things which Jesus did, which, if were written in detail, I suppose that even the world itself would not contain the books that would be written. And this is how he ends it. He identifies himself as an eyewitness. I saw these things. What I'm telling you is a true report of what I saw. And John ended up spending many, many years in prison and isolated because of his unwillingness to deny who Jesus was. And he also says that there's a lot else that could be said. But we're, like we, you know, we said before, but these things were written for a particular reason. So, summary. Jesus appeared to the disciples for a third time. It's the third time he's made himself, manifest himself or appeared in front of the disciples after his resurrection. He gave them another lesson on what he could do, and he personally cared for them, and I don't think we should pass that by. You know, the resurrected Lord personally invited them in, provided for them, fellowshipped with them, and cared for them. He confronted Peter, but not just to rub Peter's face in his failure. He confronted Peter so that Peter could gain freedom from his failures and be released into productive ministry, which that Peter was restored. And then there's this kind of uncomplicated call. Well, there's really two. Tend my sheep. That's not complicated. Follow me. That's not complicated. And that's how. And so, just as an end, as a reminder, why did he write these things? They were written so that we would believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and believing that you may have life in his name. And so we are done with John. You know, Lord, I do feel, I just had, you know, this sense about how penetrating of a question that is. You know, that do I love you with that full kind of, you know, reckless abandon love? And I honesty requires I
I don't think I could say that, God. I have deep affection, appreciation for you. I have loyalty of a kind, but I don't have the courage to just say, I love you the way you asked Peter. But what I'm grateful for, God, is just like Peter, you work with our limitations, our weakness, even when our love is not everything it should be. You work with us and you call us into service. You don't have the elite team of the couple of people in the world that love you that way. But you, every single one of us, you care for and have a desire for us to have a really significant role in the kingdom that you're building. And so I'm grateful for that, God. Really grateful. But we also, Lord, I want to love you more. I want to know you more deeply. You know, every day that I have left in this life, I just want to gain my real appreciation of how incredible and generous you are. And I do want to love you more, God. So help us to gain ground there. Amen.